you married men, how to keep your wife at home.
All you chickens out there in WGDR listening land, this is WGDR Plainfield and WGDH Hardwick, Central Vermont Community Radio. On your radio at 91.1 FM and 91.7 FM, or maybe you're listening online, either way, welcome. It's Saturday morning, guys, our favorite day of the week, my favorite day of the week. My name is Amy, and this is Amy's Kids Show. And I'm so glad that you're here, and I'm so glad the chickens are here. The chickens have been having a great time out there all week long, digging up worms and everything else they can find, all kinds of bugs. And boy, do they love to take a dust bath in that dirt. And the little baby chicks at my house are learning how to take those dust baths along with their mamas, and it's just the cutest thing. So, happy Saturday, folks. It's another gorgeous summer day out there, and this is Amy's Kids Show, so for the next hour, we're going to be hearing all kinds of great music. I've got some new music. I am always finding new music in the stacks here, and I have some great shout-outs today. In fact, I found a really good song that says, "Look Out World." And it's about turning off your TV and going outside and enjoying this amazing world, which there's never a better time of the year to do that, of course, than summertime, especially summertime here in Central Vermont, where it is just so beautiful. And I do hope people will follow the advice in that song. I know I don't watch TV much, but whenever I do happen to glance at it these days, I'm like, wow, you know, there are some reptile brains going crazy on that television, right? I mean, what's the reptile brain that we've been learning about? The lowest part of the brain that only reptiles and chickens have. And that part of the brain is interested in a pecking order, right? And where do we belong in this pecking order? And it's not fair. It's never fair, pecking orders, you know, but it sets up a way of doing things, and it certainly works. It works for chickens, and it works for reptiles and all kinds of things. But we're mammals, guys. We humans, we're mammals. So on top of that reptile brain, we also have another layer that we share with all the mammal world. And that part of the brain isn't so worried. Well, its top priority, of course, is love. It's a feeling part of the brain. This is where our feelings are. And we're going to celebrate a special mammal today, one of my favorite mammals when it comes to expressing love and being your buddy and standing by you, because those are mammal traits, right? And that's going to be a dog. So we've got some really great dog songs that I just discovered. One's about a very unpopular dog named Pie Face that ended up in the end becoming very popular. And speaking of unpopular characters, we're going to continue reading A Wrinkle in Time with my favorite unpopular fictional character, Meg, and we're going to find out what happens next in her life and what makes her unpopular. Why is that going to make her actually a very strong person? Thanks for joining me. Happy Saturday.
Like a bubble floating on the ocean, like a star burning in the sky. I don't need no suntan lotion in my portable paradise. In the oasis of my soul, I wherever I go, I can see it in your eyes. It's a portable paradise. Sometimes I worry, get in such a hurry. I try so hard to win the prize. I run so fast, I run right past my little portable paradise. And in the oasis of my soul, I carry this place wherever I go. I can see it in your eyes. It's a portable paradise. Behind the laughter, beyond the twinkling in your eyes, there is a land of happy ever after. It's a portable paradise. Hey, in the oasis of our souls, we carry this place wherever we go. And I can see in your eyes, it's a portable paradise. In the oasis of our souls, we carry this place wherever we go. I can see it in your eyes, it's a portable paradise.
Look out, world, it's a brand new day. Hey, In an old house in Paris that was covered with vines, lived 12 little girls in two straight lines. They left the house at 9:30, in snow and shine. The smallest one was Madeline.
Welcome back, folks. That little shout out to Madeline. You know, it was really funny last week because I started reading A Wrinkle in Time last week, and I read the first chapter during the show. And right before it, I played a song from Madeline, which was about a dark and stormy night. You know, something is not right. And it led us right into our story. And it was funny because at the time, even though I said the name Madeline three times in the next couple sentences, at the moment, I didn't even realize that, what a coincidence. The song was called Madeline, and it was about a little girl named Madeline. Madeline is the name of the woman who wrote this book that I'm reading, Madeline L'Engle. And then Madeline is the name of the lead character. Or no, I'm sorry, Margaret. Margaret Murray is the lead character. And I've heard that Margaret Murray, also known as Meg, she's going to be called Meg as we read along, is based on Madeline. So here we have Madeline. You know, sometimes the most obvious things are right there under your nose and you don't see them, especially as grown-ups. That's why I love having kids around, because kids, right, guys, you seem to notice the things that the grown-ups just sort of like look right over. Like, where are the cookies? They're right under your nose. Oh, yeah, there they are. Kids can always help us find those things that are right under our noses. So thank you, guys. Shout out to all the young people of all ages out there. And this is my favorite story, A Wrinkle in Time. And I just have to share the next chapter, because after I read the first chapter on the air last week, I went home and I have been reading this book. I can barely put it down and I'm almost finished. And I haven't read it since I was about 12 years old. And so now that I'm 50 and I'm reading it again, I didn't remember how the story went. And I am amazed. It's a great story. And I had a few people ask me, what happens next? What's a tesseract? Meg and her brother, you know, what's going to happen? And they met Mrs. What's-It. Do you remember what happened last week? They met Mrs. What's-It. She showed up at the house in the middle of the night. And Meg and Charles Wallace's mother is a scientist. And so is their father. He's a scientist, too, although he's been missing. And we don't know why. He sort of went missing a number of years ago. Because Charles Wallace, who's a little boy, who's about to start kindergarten next year, he doesn't really know his dad. He doesn't remember him. So he was so little when their dad went away. And Meg, the lead character, is feeling very unpopular, and she's taking it very personally that the people at school and the people in the town are giving her a hard time. And for some, you know, unfortunately, it's affecting the way she sees herself. And that's one of the great parts of this story, is she learns how awesome she is. It's not about what people think, guys. And the people who do love her most are right by her side, including Ford and Bras is our favorite character today that we're honoring, her dog. So here we go. Chapter 2, Mrs. Who. So we've met Mrs. What's-It. We're about to meet Mrs. Who. When Meg woke to the jingling of her alarm clock, the wind was still blowing, but the sun was shining, and the worst of the storm was over. She sat up in bed, shaking her head to clear it. It must have been a dream. She'd been frightened by the storm and worried about the tramp, so she'd just dreamed about it and dreamed about going down to the kitchen and seeing Mrs. What's-It and having her mother get all frightened and upset by that word. That word, what was it? Tess something. She dressed hurriedly, picked up the kitten, still curled up on the bed, and dumped it unceremoniously on the floor. The kitten yawned, stretched, gave a piteous meow, trotted out of the attic and down the stairs. Meg made her bed and hurried after it. In the kitchen, her mother was making French toast, and the twins were already at the table. The kitten was lapping milk out of a saucer. "Where's Charles?" Meg asked. "Still asleep. We had a rather interrupted night, if you remember." "Oh, I hoped it was a dream," Meg said. Her mother carefully turned over 4 slices of French toast and then said in a steady voice, "No, Meg, don't hope it was a dream. I don't understand it any more than you do, but one thing I've learned is that you don't have to understand things for them to be. I'm sorry I showed you I was upset. Your father and I used to have a joke about Tesseract." "What is a Tesseract?" Meg asked. "It's a concept," Mrs. Murray handed the twins the syrup. "I'll try to explain it to you later. There isn't time for before school." "I don't see why you didn't wake us up," Dennis said. "It's a jip we missed out on all the fun." "You'll be a lot more awake in school today than I will," Meg said as she took her French toast to the table. "Who cares?" Sandy said. "If you're going to let old tramps come into the house in the middle of the night, Mother, you ought to have Den and me around to protect you." "After all, Father would expect us to," Dennis said. "We know you have a great mind and all, Mother," Sandy said, "but you don't have much sense, and certainly Meg and Charles don't." "I know, we're morons," Meg was bitter. "I wish you wouldn't be such a dope, Meg. Syrup, please." Sandy reached across the table. "You don't have to take everything so personally. Use a happy medium, for heaven's sake. You just goof around in school and look out the window, and you don't pay any attention." "You just make things harder for yourself," Dennis said. "And Charles Wallace is going to have an awful time next year when he starts school. We know he's bright, but he's so funny when he's around other people, and they're so used to thinking he's dumb. I don't know what's going to happen to him. Sandy and I'll sock anybody who picks on him, but that's about all we can do." "Let's not worry about next year till we get through this one," Mrs. Murray said. "More French toast, boys?" At school, Meg was tired, and her eyelids sagged, and her mind wandered. In social studies, she was asked to name the principal imports and exports of Nicaragua, and though she had looked them up dutifully the night before, now she could remember none of them. The teacher was sarcastic. The rest of the class laughed, and she flung herself down in her seat in a fury. "Who cares about the imports and exports of Nicaragua, anyhow?" she muttered. "If you're going to be rude, Margaret, you may leave the room," the teacher said. "Okay, I will." Meg flounced out. During study hall, the principal sent for her. "What seems to be the problem now, Meg?" he asked, pleasantly enough. Meg looked sulkily down at the floor. "Nothing, Mr. Jenkins." "Miss Porter tells me you were inexcusably rude." Meg shrugged. "Don't you realize that you just make everything harder for yourself by your attitude?" the principal asked. "Now, Meg, I'm convinced that you can do the work and keep up with your grade if you will apply yourself. But some of your teachers are not. You're going to have to do something about yourself. Nobody can do it for you." Meg was silent. Well, what about it, Meg?
I don't know what to do, Meg said.
You could do your homework, for one thing. Wouldn't your mother help you?
If I asked her to.
Meg, is something troubling you? Are you unhappy at home? Mr. Jenkins asked.
At last, Meg looked at him, pushing her glasses in a characteristic gesture. Everything's fine at home.
I'm glad to hear it, but I know it must be hard on you to have your father away.
Meg eyed the principal warily, ran her tongue over the barbed line of her braces.
Have you had any news from him lately?
Meg was sure it was not only imagination that made her feel that behind Mr. Jenkins' surface concern was a gleam of avid curiosity. Wouldn't he like to know, she thought. And if I knew anything, he's the last person I'd tell. Well, one of the last. The postmistress must know that it was almost a year now since the last letter from her father. And heaven knows how many people she'd told, or what unkind guesses she's made about the reason for the long silence. Mr. Jenkins waited for an answer, but Meg only shrugged.
Just what was your father's line of business? Mr. Jenkins asked. Some kind of a scientist, wasn't he?
He is a physicist, Meg bared her teeth to reveal two ferocious lines of braces.
Meg, don't you think you'd make a better adjustment to life if you faced facts?
I do face facts, Meg said. They're a lot easier to face than people, I can tell you.
Then why don't you face facts about your father?
You leave my father out of it, Meg shouted.
Stop bellowing, Mr. Jenkins said sharply. Do you want the entire school to hear you?
So what? Meg demanded. I'm not ashamed of anything I'm saying. Are you?
Mr. Jenkins sighed. Do you enjoy being the most belligerent, uncooperative child in school?
Meg ignored this. She leaned over the desk toward the principal. Mr. Jenkins, you've met my mother, haven't you? You can't accuse her of not facing facts, can you? She's a scientist. She has a doctor's degree in both biology and bacteriology. Her business is facts. When she tells me that my father isn't coming home, I'll believe it. As long as she says father is coming home, then I'll believe that.
Mr. Jenkins sighed again. Oh, no doubt your mother wants to believe that your father is coming home, Meg. Very well. I can't do anything else with you. Go on back to study hall and try to be a little less antagonistic. Maybe your work would improve if your general attitude were more tractable.
When Meg got home from school, her mother was in the lab. The twins were at Little League, and little Charles Wallace, the kitten, and Fortinbras, her dog, were waiting for her. Fortinbras jumped up, put his front paws on her shoulders, and gave her a kiss. And the kitten rushed to his empty saucer and meowed loudly.
Come on, Charles Wallace said. Let's go.
Where? Meg said. I'm hungry, Charles. I don't want to go anywhere till I've had something to eat. She was still sore from the interview with Mr. Jenkins, and her voice sounded cross. Charles Wallace looked at her thoughtfully as she went to the refrigerator and gave the kitten some milk and then drank a mugful herself. He handed her a paper bag. Here's a sandwich and some cookies and an apple. I thought we'd better go see Mrs. What's-It.
Oh, golly, Meg said. Why, Charles?
You're still uneasy about her, aren't you? Charles asked.
Well, yes.
Don't be. She's all right. I promise you. She's on our side.
How do you know?
Meg, he said impatiently, I know.
But why should we go see her now?
I want to find out more about that Tesseract thing. Didn't you see how it upset Mother? You know when Mother can't control the way she feels, when she lets us see that she's upset, then it's something big.
Meg thought for a moment. Okay, let's go, but let's take Fortinbras with us.
Well, of course, he needs exercise. They set off, Fortinbras rushing ahead, then doubling back to the two children, then leaping off again. The Murrays lived about 4 miles out of the village. Behind the house was a pine woods, and it was through this that Charles Wallace took Meg. "Charles, you know she's going to get in awful trouble, Mrs. What's-It, I mean, if they find out she's broken into the haunted house. And taking Mrs. Buncombe's sheets and everything, they could send her to jail. One of the reasons I want to go this afternoon is to warn them." "Them? I told you she was there with two of her friends. I'm not even sure it was Mrs. What's-It herself who took the sheets, though I wouldn't put it past her." "But what would she want all those sheets for?" "I intend to ask her," Charles Wallace said, "and to tell them they'd better be more careful. I don't really think they'll let anybody find them, but I just thought we ought to mention the possibility. Sometimes during vacations, some of the boys go out there looking for thrills, but I don't think anybody's apt to right now, what with basketball and everything." They walked in silence for a moment through the fragrant woods, the rusty pine needles gentle under their feet. Up above them, the wind made music in the branches. Charles Wallace slipped his hand confidingly in Meg's, and the sweet little boy gesture warmed her so that she felt the tense knot inside her begin to loosen. "Charles loves me at any rate," she thought. "School awful again today, Meg?" he asked after a while. "Yes, I got sent to Mr. Jenkins. He made snide remarks about Father." Charles Wallace nodded sagely. "I know." "How do you know?" Charles Wallace shook his head. "I can't quite explain. You tell me, that's all." "But I've never said anything. You just seem to know, Charles." "Everything about you tells me," Charles said. "How about the twins?" Meg asked. "Do you know about them, too?" "I suppose I could if I wanted to, if they needed me. But it's sort of tiring, so I just concentrate on you and Mother." "Do you mean you read our minds?" Charles Wallace looked troubled. "I don't think it's that. It's being able to understand a sort of language. Like, sometimes if I concentrate very hard, I can understand the wind talking with the trees. You tell me, you see, sort of inadvertently. That's a good word, isn't it? I got Mother to look it up in the dictionary for me this morning. I really must learn to read. Except I'm afraid it will make it awfully hard for me in school next year if I already know things. I think it will be better if people go on thinking I'm not very bright. They won't hate me quite so much." Ahead of them, Fortinbras started barking loudly, the warning bay that usually told them that a car was coming up the road or that someone was at the door. "Somebody's here," Charles Wallace said sharply. "Somebody's hanging around the house. Come on." He started to run, his short legs straining. At the edge of the woods, Fortinbras stood in front of a boy, barking ferociously. As they came panting up, the boy said, "For crying out loud, call off your dog." "Who is he?" Charles Wallace asked Meg. "Kelvin O'Keefe. He's in regional, but he's older than I am. He's a big bug." "It's all right, fella. I'm not going to hurt you," the boy said to Fortinbras. "Sit, Fort," Charles commanded, and Fortinbras dropped to his haunches in front of the boy, a low growl still pulsing in his dark throat. "Okay," Charles Wallace put his hands on his hips. "Now tell us what you're doing here." "I might ask you the same thing," the boy said with some indignation. "Aren't you two of the Murray kids? This isn't your property, is it?" He started to move, but Fortinbras' growl grew louder as he stopped. "Tell me about him, Meg," Charles Wallace demanded. "What would I know about him?" Meg asked. "He's a couple of grades above me, and he's on the basketball team." "Just because I'm tall," Kelvin sounded a little embarrassed as he said that. Tall, he certainly was, and skinny. His bony wrists stuck out of the sleeves of his blue sweater. His worn corduroy trousers were 3 inches too short. He had orange hair that needed cutting and the appropriate freckles to go with it. His eyes were an oddly bright blue. "Tell us what you're doing here," Charles Wallace said. "What is this, the third degree? Aren't you the one who's supposed to be the moron?" Meg flushed with rage, but Charles Wallace answered placidly, "That's right. If you want to call my dog off, you'd better give." "Most peculiar moron I've ever met," Kelvin said. "I just came to get away from my family." Charles Wallace nodded. "What kind of family?" "They all have runny noses. I'm third from the top of 11 kids. I'm a sport." At that, Charles Wallace grinned widely. "So am I." "I don't mean like baseball," Kelvin said. "Neither do I." "I mean like biology," Kelvin said suspiciously. "A change in gene," Charles Wallace quoted, "resulting in the appearance of the offspring of a character which is not present in the parents, but which is potentially transmissible to its offspring." "What gives around here?" Kelvin asked. "I was told you couldn't talk." "Thinking I'm a moron gives people something to feel smug about," Charles Wallace said. "Why should I disillusion them?" "How old are you, Kelvin?"
14.
"What grade?"
"Junior, 11th. I'm bright. Listen, did anybody ask you to come here this afternoon?"
Charles Wallace, holding Fort by the collar, looked at Kelvin suspiciously. "What do you mean, asked?" Kelvin shrugged. "You still don't trust me, do you?"
"I don't distrust you," Charles Wallace said.
"Do you want to tell me why you're here, then?"
"Fort and Meg and I decided to go for a walk. We often do in the afternoon."
Kelvin dug his hands down in his pockets. "You're holding out on me."
"So are you," Charles Wallace said.
"Okay, old sport," Kelvin said. "I'll tell you this much. Sometimes I get a feeling about things. You might call it a compulsion. Do you know what a compulsion means?"
"Constraint, obligation, because one is compelled."
"Not a very good definition, but it's the concise Oxford."
"Okay, okay," Kelvin sighed. "I must remember I'm preconditioned in my concept of your mentality."
Meg sat down on the coarse grass at the edge of the woods. Fort gently twisted his collar out of Charles Wallace's hands and came over to Meg, lying down beside her and putting his head in her lap. Kelvin tried now politely to direct his words toward Meg as well as to Charles Wallace.
"When I get this feeling, this compulsion, I always do what it tells me. I can't explain where it comes from or how I get it, and it doesn't happen very often, but I obey it. And this afternoon, I had a feeling that I must come over to the haunted house. That's all I know, kid. I'm not holding anything back. Maybe it's because I'm supposed to meet you. You tell me."
Charles Wallace looked at Kelvin probingly for a moment. Then an almost glazed look came into his eyes, and he seemed to be thinking at him. Kelvin stood very still and waited. At last, Charles Wallace said,
"Okay, I believe you, but I can't tell you. I think I'd like to trust you. Maybe you'd better come home with us and have dinner."
"Well, sure, but what would your mother say to that?" Kelvin asked.
"She'd be delighted. Mother's all right. She's not one of us, but she's all right."
"What about Meg?"
"Meg has it tough," Charles Wallace said. "She's not really one thing or the other."
"What do you mean, one of us?" Meg demanded. "What do you mean I'm not one thing or the other?"
"Not now, Meg," Charles Wallace said. "Slowly. I'll tell you about it later."
He looked at Kelvin, then seemed to make a quick decision.
"Okay, let's take him to meet Mrs. What's-It. If he's not okay, she'll know."
He started off on his short legs toward the dilapidated old house. The haunted house was half in the shadows of the clump of elms in which it stood.
The elms were almost bare now, and the ground around the house was yellow with damp leaves. The late afternoon light had a greenish cast, which the black windows reflected in a sinister way. An unhinged shutter thumped. Something else creaked. Meg did not wonder that the house had a reputation for being haunted. A board was nailed across the front door, but Charles Wallace led the way around the back. The door there appeared to be nailed shut too, but Charles Wallace knocked, and the door swung slowly outward, creaking on its rusty hinges. Up in one of the elms, an old black crow gave its raucous cry, and a woodpecker went into a wild rat-a-tat-tat-tat-tat-tat. A large gray rat scuttled around the corner of the house, and Meg let out a stifled shriek. "They get a lot of fun out of using all the typical props," Charles Wallace said in a reassuring voice. "Come on, follow me." Kelvin put a strong hand to Meg's elbow, and Fort pressed against her leg. Happiness at their concern was so strong in her that her panic fled, and she followed Charles Wallace into the dark recesses of the house without fear. They entered into a sort of kitchen. There was a huge fireplace with a big black pot hanging over a merry fire. Why had there been no smoke visible from the chimney? Something in the pot was bubbling, and it smelled more like one of Mrs. Murray's chemical messes than something to eat. In a dilapidated Boston rocker sat a plump little woman. She wasn't Mrs. What's-It, so she must, Meg decided, be one of Mrs. What's-It's two friends. She wore enormous spectacles, twice as thick and twice as large as Meg's, and she was sewing busily with rapid jabbing stitches on a sheet. Several other sheets lay in the dusty floor. Charles Wallace went up to her. "I really don't think you ought to have taken Mrs. Buncombe's sheets without consulting me," he said, as cross and bossy as only a very small boy can be. "What on earth do you want to do with them?" The plump little woman beamed at him. "Why, Charlesy, my pet, le coeur a ses raisons que la raison ne connaît point. That's French. Pascal. The heart has its reasons, whereof reason knows nothing." "But that's not appropriate at all," Charles said crossly. "Your mother would find it so." A smile gleamed through the roundness of her spectacles. "I'm not talking about my mother's feelings about my father," Charles Wallace scolded. "I'm talking about Mrs. Buncombe's sheets." The little woman sighed. The enormous glasses caught the light again and shone like an owl's eyes. "In case we need ghosts, of course," she said. "I should think you'd have guessed. If we have to frighten anyone away, what's it thought we ought to do it appropriately? That's why it's so much fun to stay in a haunted house. But if we really didn't mean for you, we really didn't mean for you to know about the sheets. Offerscar tot erept. That's German. In flagrant delecto. Latin. Caught in the act. English. As I was saying." But Charles Wallace held up his hand in a peremptory gesture. "Mrs. Who, do you know this boy?" Kelvin bowed. "Good afternoon, ma'am. I didn't quite catch your name." "Mrs. Who will do," the woman said. "He wasn't my idea, Charlesy, but I think he's a good one." "Where's Mrs. What's-It?" Charles asked. "She's busy. It's getting near time, Charlesy, getting near time. Ab honesto virum bonum nihil deterret. Seneca. Nothing deters a good man from doing what is honorable. And he's a very good man, Charlesy, darling, but right now he needs our help." "Who?" Meg demanded. "And little Megsy, lovely to meet you, sweetheart. Your father, of course. Now go home, loves. The time is not yet ripe. Don't worry, we won't go without you.
Get plenty of food and rest. Feed Kelvin up. Now, off with you. Justitate soro fides. Latin again, of course. Faith is the sister of justice. Trust in us. Now shoo! And she fluttered up from her chair and pushed them out the door with surprising power. Charles, Meg said, I don't understand. Charles took her by the hand and dragged her away from the house. Fortinbras ran on ahead, and Kelvin was close behind them. No, he said, I don't either, yet. Not quite. I'll tell you what I know as soon as I can. But you saw Fort, didn't you? Not a growl. Not a quiver. Just as though there weren't anything strange about it. So you know that it's okay. Look, do me a favor, both of you. Let's not talk about it till we've had something to eat. I need fuel so I can sort things out and assimilate them properly. Lead on, moron, Kelvin cried gaily. I've never even seen your house, and I have the funniest feeling that for the first time in my life, I'm going home. The end. Well, that's not the end of the story, of course. That's the end of chapter 2. And we are reading A Wrinkle in Time. And just like Charles Wallace, the little boy, and Meg, his older sister, and their new friend, Kelvin, who's a basketball player from school, who they just met, they're all going to go home and get something to eat. And I think that's a fantastic idea. If anybody out there hasn't had their second breakfast yet today, or maybe not even your first, then let's go have something to eat. And I have some great shout outs to dogs, to our best friends like Fortinbras, who help us to tell, you know, friend from foe and safety from danger. And they're always by our side, right? And so we can face anything if we've got our Fortinbras with us. And so we've got a couple of really good songs coming up. This next one is a story. It's another story about a famous dog. Well, actually, he started out being very unpopular, kind of the way Meg does in this story, right? This dog called Pie Face starts out very unpopular, but ends up being like famous across the country and being a hero, which of course he is, because a lot of unpopular people are heroes. That's why popularity really doesn't matter. It's luck of the draw, folks. So don't worry about it. What part of the pecking order you're at, just look around and I'm sure you're going to find all kinds of friends who are going to be there with you. And they love you. And love is what being a mammal is all about. We're celebrating mammals. So let's get on to celebrating my favorite mammal, doggies. Here we go, guys. Thanks for joining me. Enjoy the story.
He was the run of the litter. He had a shiny black nose, and he ate his dinner from a pie plate. That's how he got his name. He'd greet the kids with anticipation. Little did he know that a grateful nation would one day celebrate that silly little name. Most folks said he was just no good, a useless stray, and it was understood the kids were told to leave that dog alone. Then one afternoon he went out of control, barking and howling to let everyone know little Carrie was in trouble and she wouldn't be coming home. Carrie's dad used to run him off each day. Now he followed Pie Face as he led the way to an abandoned factory near a well that echoed Carrie's fears. And down into that well they lowered a light, and the TV cameras zoomed in tight as the world watched and prayed and fought away its tears. It was cold and wet that ugly night. Little Carrie was barely clinging to life when the chief said, "It doesn't look good. We're almost out of time." Through the black of night, they dug into the ground, praying to hear even the slightest sound to let them know that Carrie was still alive.
Rescue teams continue to work around the clock in their attempt to save the life of the little child.
All of America is focused on Wheeling, West Virginia, where Carrie Osborne is still at the
bottom. Carrie Osborne fights for her life.
My face, where have you been? Looks like you're in trouble again.
The mouth of that well was just too small. Carrie's dad said, "Hey, what about the dog?" Someone said, "I got a harness in the back of my truck." They harnessed Pie Face and hooked on a line, and Carrie's dad said, "Everything's gonna be fine," as he patted Pie Face on the head. And he said, "Go on, boy, bring us some luck." As they lowered Pie Face into the ground, he begged for just the slightest sound. But the cold, dark chasm he entered that night was mute. He felt like he was down there all alone, like Carrie had somehow made it home. Then her limp little body faded into view. He couldn't hold back as he whimpered with fright and the cry of anguish that cut through the night. He licked her pale little face. She suddenly opened her eyes. And everyone cheered because they knew Carrie was down there and she was alive. He clamped on her dress with his strong little jaws as they hoisted them up to the grateful applause of a waiting world that had prayed she'd be okay. Now the little girl was safe and sound thanks to the love of that no-good hound that nobody cared a thing about just yesterday.
Pie Face, where have you been? Looks like you're in trouble again.
That little dog is gone. Carrie's grown up, and she's even got a little girl of her own. And at the mouth of that well, there's a simple bronze plaque. It says,
"Pie Face,
you've finally found a home."
I'm talking about the singing, swinging, spring spaniel, Webster the singing dog. Here's Webster and the Ragtops.
Webster is the dog he rides in the front seat, with his head out the window and his tongue in the breeze.
This is the song.
Webster the singing dog. Webster the singing dog, and he sings along with the radio on. When he's not on television, then he's out in the sun. He ran for mayor of Cincinnati.
sing to me.
Gotta hear Webster the singing dog sing to me. Gotta hear Webster the singing dog sing to me. Ah!
This is a
This is a song, some of you probably heard me sing it many, many years ago, but I've been singing it a long time. And it's a song that I learned from some of the Freedom Riders. It's called Guide Me.
Guide my hands while I run this race. Guide my hands while I run this race. Guide my hands while I run this race, 'cause I don't want to run this race in vain. Guide my feet, guide my feet while I run this race. Guide my feet while I run this race. Guide my feet while I run this race, 'cause I don't want to run this race in vain. Guide my head,
guide my head while I run this race. Guide my head while I run this race. Guide my head while I run this race, 'cause I don't want to run this race in vain.
Guide my heart,
guide my heart while I run this race. Guide my heart while I run this race.
Guide my heart
while I run this race. 'Cause I don't want to run this race in vain.
Folks, welcome back. We are nearly at the end of Amy's Kids Show today. It's been a wonderful Saturday of celebrating mammals and mammal brains and mammal love. And of course, we had some of our favorite mammals, the dogs. We did some shout outs to those guys who are by our side. And all of this sort of talk of mammal love and how we stick together and work together, it's reminding me of a story I just heard recently about some really amazing mammals who live out on the prairie. You know, give me a home where the buffalo roam and the deer and the antelope play, right? That's out in the prairie, out west, right? Where there are big prairies and there are buffalo roaming around and antelope and deer. And I heard recently that when a big storm comes out west, which a lot of big storms come there because it's very flat and the storms can really get going and they can get really big and they can spread across the sky and you can see them coming. Well, what happens is the deer and the antelope, they have one way of dealing with it, right? That they're in a herd, they stick together, they get all together, and they get afraid, right? They're scared because here comes this big, gigantic storm. What are we going to do? And they all start running away from the storm. Well, if you run away from the storm, well, the storm is going to catch up.
And if you're running away from it, you're actually going to stay in the storm a lot longer, right? Because you're going to be running with the storm now. And so it's going to take longer for you to get through it. Well, here's what the buffalo do, guys. They do something different. They see the storm coming. And those strong, the strongest, bravest, most courageous, maybe they're the smallest, they might not be the strongest, but they are the most courageous buffalo, get in the front. And they say, come on, guys, we're running into the storm. And they start charging all together, packed together with the little babies and the older folks in the middle so they can keep them safe. And they go running as a herd into the storm. Now, when they run into the storm, guess what happens? They run through it faster, way faster than the deer and the antelope, because now they're cutting right through it, and they're going to get to the other side faster, and the storm's going to be going one way, and they're going to be going the other, and they're going to be like passing like cars on the two sides of the highway, right? It's going to be a lot faster. And so I just thought, wow, isn't that a great way of thinking about it, right? If we stick together and we have courage and we are empowered and we know what we know, right, from our experience, and we love each other, imagine how much easier things would be. We could get through all our troubles so much better, right? And I think that's what mammal brains are for. You know, they give us complicated feelings too, and sometimes we take things too personally, like Meg Murray in our story. But her buddies are there, right? And she is being courageous. She's going to find her father and to find out what a tesseract is. Guys, join me next week and we'll learn more about A Wrinkle in Time. Thank you. Have a wonderful, wonderful summer day. You're the greatest.
Like a bubble floating on the ocean, like a star burning in the sky. I don't need no suntan lotion in my portable paradise. In the oasis of my soul, I carry this place wherever. Sometimes I worry, get in such a hurry. I try so hard to win the prize. I run so fast, I run right past my little portable paradise. And in the oasis of my soul, I carry this place wherever I go, and I can see it in